Well, good morning, everyone. I just can't help but start by thanking all of you for your wonderful presence. And I remember years ago Swamiji saying, "You all thank me, but don't you understand? I need you just as much as you need me." And that puzzled me for a long time. How could Swami possibly need us? But I understood that it's receptive hearts that draw the truth from people who are trying to channel them. And you all have just been so wonderful and so deep. And I wish we would have had time to connect with more of you who have come from afar, from Seattle and different places. But we, in our hearts, we made a connection with you all. And it's just been wonderful. And I also want to thank Surya, who, if you notice, we've had these beautiful visuals every day. Well, he was the one who made all that happen. So today is the last in the, of the classes we'll be giving on the scriptures. And there's, I hope for you, and it's true for me, I feel like this is just a beginning. I feel like what we've talked about has really just scratched the surface, and we could spend weeks and weeks, as the great masters do in India, on one sentence, one phrase. But we've tried to just paint with broad strokes the depth of what the depth and the essence of what these scriptures offer us. And we hope you will continue your study. We have wonderful commentaries that Master gave us, the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, the revelations of Christ, an autobiography of a yogi, that, and just to read Patanjali, as we said, we can make available to you. Oh, and of course, demystifying Patanjali. I shouldn't forget that. So we have all, and they're all based on Master's teaching. So continue your study. And I wanted to share these words from the Bhagavad Gita about relating to the scriptures. This is from chapter 16. And Krishna says to Arjuna, "One who ignores the commands of scripture and follows his own ego-driven desires finds neither happiness nor fulfillment nor the supreme goal of life. Take true scripture, therefore, as your guide in determining what should be done and what should be avoided. With intuitive understanding of the injunctions in holy writ, perform your earthly duties." And so this is our challenge, to go deeper in what the scriptures are teaching us and to try to deeply understand them. And of course, we can delude ourselves and say, "Oh, well, that's what that means." And we can say, "Well, I don't have a guru in the body now, so I can kind of, if this feels like the course of least resistance, that must be the right way to go." No, it's not. I'll say this as a kind of a blanket statement. The course of least resistance is never the way to go. Easy is the descent into hell. And Master said, "When I see you having moods, it hurts me, because I know then Satan has gotten a hold of you." And so watch those little things, watch the moods, the downward pulling energy. "Oh, I'll never be happy. Things are never going to be right. It's always going to be like this." Though it's a self-defeating prophecy, self-fulfilling prophecy. "I'll never be happy. Things will never be good." Our job is to defeat Maya, not to cave into it. Our job is to say, "It will be right through God's grace and through self-effort." And just as we said with Patanjali, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga, and now we come to an examination of a book that is more than a book. A book that is a living reality, the autobiography of a yogi. It's a living reality because Master's consciousness is with all those who are open to him. There was a story that one of Master's direct disciples tells. He was a young man from Europe, and he was looking for his guru. And he read Autobiography of a Yogi, and he felt such a calling to follow it. But this was after Master had already left the body. And he said, oh no, I need a living guru. I need someone to tell me what to do. And he heard that a great saint of India, Swami Ram Dass, not the American, but an Indian man, was giving a lecture near where he lived in Europe. And he went to see this lecture, and he was very inspired. And then afterwards, he came up to Ram Dass, and he said, will you be my guru? And Ram Dass, being a man of God, said, I am not your guru. Yogananda is your guru. And he said, but Yogananda's dead. And Ram Dass replied to him, no, you are dead. Yogananda is alive. And so it is. We need to remember, just as with the scriptures and with the autobiography of a yogi, they are living if we come to them with openness of heart and receptivity and not thinking, well, my way has to be right. Master said of his most advanced disciple, Rajasi Janakananda, the secret of his spiritual attainment was one thing, receptivity. He was open without any barriers to the guru. And this is what we need to strive to be, not to kid ourselves. And when we feel the inner promptings, when we're acting in such a way that we think, I shouldn't be saying this, I shouldn't be doing this, but we override it and we say, no, 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 it's okay. What are we doing? The guru is whispering to us, not to judge us, not to punish us, but merely to say that way will not bring you happiness. That way of thinking or acting or speaking will only build a wall between you and me. But when you feel those inner promptings and you say, okay, Master, I'll try to do better. I remember once I had spoken without discrimination, said something to someone, and it caused a kerfuffle. And it was the wrong thing to do. And Swamiji really laid into me. I mean, it was the most he'd ever kind of disciplined me or gave me negative feedback. And he said, when will you learn to shut your mouth? Like that. And what do you say, you know? But I was so pleased because the blessing in that was I watched my reaction, and there wasn't any self-justification in front of Swami. I didn't try to say, well, you know, I did part of it, but then the other person did that other part, and that's why it all got mixed up. I just said, I won't do it again, Swami. And he said, good. Now is the end. But so even when we make a mistake, if we can kind of open our heart and say, Master, I blew it. And maybe we blow it in big ways, big, big ways. It doesn't matter to them, to the great ones, because they're trying to steer us out of our delusions. And so if we can just say, you know, I made a mistake, I won't do it again. And without any trying to cover your tracks, justify your ego, that's what works. That's what unties the knots. In case you're wondering, did I ever speak indiscriminately again? Well, yeah, I did. But over time, I caught it more and more. I could feel that certain vibration of energy that was going to be off. And then I just, okay, here we go. Let's see if we can avoid this. And little by little, you develop that ability. If you say, I'm trying to change this in myself. So we've been talking about, in the cosmic scheme of things, how the scriptures have fit in. And we began with the Gita, which, as we said in the first class, was the very cusp between descending Dwapara and the beginning of Kali Yuga. And Jyotish wanted to mention this, but he forgot, and I hope I'm not stealing what you were going to say. But he said, even though autobiography on the other end of ascending Dwapara is farther into Dwapara Yuga than, and Bhagavad Gita was into Kali, the Gita was drawing from the higher wisdom of a higher age of Treta, even though it was coming down. Whereas, even though autobiography was a little higher into Dwapara, it was being pulled down by the consciousness of Kali Yuga. And so those times where they fall into chronological time doesn't really, it's not accurate, because it's like we're drawing from higher ages, being pulled down from lower ages. And so it's, the Gita, even though it was that point in time, reflects higher truths than the time in which it was given to mankind. And then we come to Patanjali, about 450 years into Kali Yuga. And then we come down to the Bible, and then we begin moving up. And what the autobiography is illumining, and what Master's mission was, as he said, illumining the truths of the Gita, the Bible, Patanjali, for our time. And so it's just as our line of gurus, as we know, have come again and again throughout history at pivotal points in human development. One might even say the autobiography of a yogi is the culmination of the great world scriptures for our time and sheds light on how we can relate to them. So it is great on so many levels, so many levels. And you know, I know I've had this experience, and many, many people I speak to have said the same thing in reading autobiography. Every time you read it, it's like a different book. You think, oh my gosh, I skipped that chapter last time. Or I didn't, that whole passage, somehow it got inserted. Well, why is that? Does the book change? No, it's the consciousness that we come to it with. And the more time goes by, and the more we see that our minds become more in tune with the guru, we can read it and we think, yes, I get it. I get what you're saying. And I love to think about Swamiji reading it, you know, when he was 22, been deeply seeking God, truth, meaning, purpose in life. And then he came to the autobiography, and in 3 days, he just absorbed it. He just drank it in because he was so ready. For the rest of us, it's like dipping our toe in the water and I'll take this much, but not anymore. He just said that was the complete break with his past life. And so when I read it, I try to read it now, these days, I try to read it through his eyes. What was it like for Swami when he read the autobiography? What was he seeing? What was he feeling? What was he remembering? And I remember in the early days when I first heard Swami lecture, the summer of 1969 when I first came, he presented it all so clearly that I thought, I had to backtrack because I thought, oh, I know all this. I know all the stuff that he's talking about. And it took me some time to realize, you don't really know it. It's familiar because he's speaking to your soul. But you have to go deep with this and make it your own. And the more we're involved with our moods and our happiness and our unhappiness and this relationship and that relationship, the more we just, it's like we put up a big wall and we come to the autobiography and we think, oh yeah, okay, there's a chapter about a tiger, I remember that. And we're missing the whole point of it. But it's a living, speaking scripture, and the more we address it as such, the more we come to it with that openness. But our class this morning will be shorter because we're going to have the vow ceremony. But I just wanted to touch on, for me, what I think are the two main themes of the autobiography and why it is so important for us now. And they go hand in glove, discipleship and Kriya Yoga. And if you read the autobiography, really from first to last, it's about discipleship. And this is something that the West really doesn't have much of a clue about. You know, the big yoga magazines and journals in the West, they eschew the guru-disciple relationship. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to go there because somebody has power over you and somebody will control you. But the guru-disciple relationship is, as we all know, most of us are disciples, most of us are Kriyabans. It's the God coming to us to say, come to me, I will help you, I can train you, I can show you the way out. And when I look at, we're so fortunate to be trained by a direct disciple of Master in Swamiji, because he did it so lightly. You never even realized a whole lot, except when he really had to level you flat like he did to me that time. But you didn't realize that he was training you. It was so subtle. And the guru-disciple relationship is the vehicle through which we find God. There's really no other way. There is no other way. And Kriya is the technique of discipleship. That's why we don't give it unless someone's taken discipleship. And I wanted to just read this passage from, brief passage from autobiography, Years in My Master's Hermitage. And it begins with Sri Yukteswar speaking. Even when Lahiri Mahashaya was silent, Sri Yukteswar told me, or when he conversed on other than strictly religious topics, I discovered that nonetheless he had transmitted to me ineffable knowledge. The master goes on. Sri Yukteswar affected me similarly. If I entered the hermitage in a worried or indifferent frame of mind, my attitude imperceptibly changed. A healing calm descended at mere sight of my guru. Every day with him was a new experience in joy, peace, and wisdom. Never did I find him deluded or intoxicated with greed or emotion or anger or any human attachment. The darkness of Maya is silently approaching. Let us hie homeward within, end quote. With these words at dusk, Master constantly reminded his disciples of their need for Kriya Yoga. And so Kriya is the technique that emerges from Autobiography of a Yogi. And once, Swami, we were having, someone was coming to give a series of lectures here on marketing. And someone who was a professional in the field. And he said something like, you have to be enticing to people. And we were driving, and, you know, not put it all out there. We were driving home in the car with Swamiji afterwards, and he said, talk about a genius of marketing. What about the line in Autobiography of a Yogi where he said, this technique cannot be given in these written pages. It must be received. And he said, talk about enticing. And that's what he was doing. He was trying to say, if you feel my vibration, if you want to make it your own, do Kriya, practice Kriya. It's the technique for liberation of this age. And my vibration will help you to practice it. And for many people I know who even have been practicing Kriya for some time, they say, oh, I don't think I'm making progress. I don't feel the currents, or I don't see the light. Don't worry. Just keep calling on the guru. Swamiji said that when he would do Kriya, he would visualize like his spine was an elevator shaft and the master was going up, resting for a moment at the spiritual eye, and then coming down. He said, but I tried to feel that energy within me was the living presence of master. And so it is. And the deeper we go in Kriya, the more we realize that. But I love that sentence. Every day with my master was a new experience in joy. And so our lives can be too. Every day, no matter what's going on around us, if people are behaving foolishly or wisely, hurtfully or helpfully, every day we need to awaken within us that joy, ever new joy, through the practice of Kriya and through our discipleship. And this is what the autobiography gives us. It is the condensation of the wisdom of the past, repurposed for the consciousness of modern man. And there is a book that a friend of ours wrote, American Veda, by Phil Goldberg, very fine man who's spoken here. And it's the history of Vedic thought in the West, in America. And he said in that book, and he did a great deal of research, he said there is not one spiritual teacher in the West or one organization, spiritual organization, that does not draw its roots from Autobiography of a Yogi. So it's a movement. It's not just words on paper. And remember when Swamiji first met Master on that day, September 12, 1948, he knelt before him and Master asked him, "How did you like my book?" And he said, "Very well, sir." He said, "That's because I put my vibrations in it." So more than the Gita is a source of unending inspiration. Bible formed the consciousness of the West. Patanjali is a roadmap. But for us, the autobiography of a yogi speaks to us in the language of our times. We don't have to translate it from the Sanskrit. We don't have to translate it from ancient Aramaic. It's written to reflect the needs of modern people, of our times. And it came out into the world at a turning point in human history. And I invite you to approach it with awe and respect and unresisting love. When you read it, I remember I began reading Autobiography of a Yogi before I came to Ananda, 1969. But I couldn't get into it too much. I was finishing up college. Then I came here, and I remember I was up at the meditation retreat, sitting under that big oak tree outside the temple. And I remember sitting there for hours, unmoving, reading it. And then it was just like, oh, now I get it, now I get it, now I get it. And then I remember after several hours stretching, I was sitting cross-legged on the ground, and then I just put my hand behind me, and I touched something. It felt a little funny. And I turned around, and there was a rattlesnake that was sleeping, coiled up, sleeping right behind me. And I don't know how long it had been there, but I just looked, and I turned around, and it didn't wake up. And I got it very quietly, and I went into the dining room. And on those days, it was Thursday, and we would keep silence. And so I couldn't say anything, but I found a piece of paper, and I wrote, "Snake, snake!" And I was enjoying it. But it was with that kind of absorption that I could feel. And there was a statement in that. Even a little practice of this autobiography of a yogi will free you from dire fears. And so it was. Master was saying, "Stick with me, kid, and I'll protect you. Whatever fears or sufferings come along." And so cling to that book. Cling to it. Use it as your guide, as your oracle, as your harbor, as your protection. It's living because it has our guru's living presence. And the teachings in it, every page is filled with something that uplifts the mind, stimulates the intellect, opens the heart, and gives one a sense that God is real and we can find him. So discipleship and Kriya Yoga for our times, for modern man. When we travel in India, so many people say, oh yes, I read autobiography years ago, but then I didn't do anything with it. And we said, that's why we've come. So we can all do something with it now. And there was a, I'll just close and then Jyotish will speak. There was a science fiction book by Ray Bradbury called Fahrenheit 451, yeah. And it was in the future where there was a totalitarian government and all books had been burned. And so there was a little community of people who had withdrawn from civilization and they had all memorized a book. And this person finds his way there, the hero of the story. And people walk up to him and they say, hello, I'm Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. And hello, I'm, you know, each one was a different book. Well, let's all become autobiographies of the Yogis. So that when people meet us, they feel the goodness and the depth and the richness of our guru pouring from us.
Like Devi, I just want to speak, I don't know, from the depths of my heart about my experience of the autobiography. I didn't have a spiritual life before I read that book. I had spiritual yearnings. I wouldn't even have at that time identified them as spiritual yearnings. I wanted to understand consciousness, but I didn't put consciousness and spirit together. But until I had that book in my hands and read it, it was as if my heart hadn't really been awakened. And so for me, that book brings all of these scriptures together. It's like a lake or an ocean in which all of these different streams flow into it. Until I read Autobiography of a Yogi, maybe I had heard of the Bhagavad Gita. Certainly I hadn't read it, and most certainly I did not understand it if I had read anything of it. I remember soon after reading the autobiography, within, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, I started taking classes from Swamiji, and then I, very shortly after that, I had a vacation from my job, and I went and I camped down near Santa Cruz in the Redwoods down there, where we now have a center in that area. And at that time, I thought, well, among other things, I want to read a spiritual book. I'll take the Autobiography of a Yogi with me. This was in the Bhagavad Gita with me. This was in 1967. And when I read the first chapter and Krishna told Arjuna that you have to fight, I just about threw it away. It was in the height of the Vietnam War. I was anti-war. And to hear a message that you have to fight, you have to be in a war, seemed to me to be anti-spirit, anti-wisdom. And of course, fortunately, I had at least enough humility to say, maybe I don't understand what Krishna is saying here. And so that didn't take me off of the spiritual path. But the autobiography allows us to begin to understand things that we have no clue of what they really mean. At the time I read Autobiography, I had, probably from the time I was 12 or 13, rejected the church that I grew up in. It just didn't seem relevant to me. And therefore, along with it, I rejected the Bible, because it seemed just old and not much wisdom and filled with things that didn't resonate with me. And there again, I came back to Christianity. I came back to Christ. I came back to the Bible through the doorway of the autobiography. And I know that's true of many, many people. Also, there are many, many people who never had to leave the Bible or never had to leave, you know, when we speak in India, people grew up with the Gita. They didn't have to leave the Gita, find the autobiography, but many of them left the essence of it. In India, we often hear, oh, I'm not interested in my grandfather's religion. Or their grandfather's religion is, at least hopefully, it's Hinduism with the admixture of Vedanta and the Gita, but it isn't relevant to them. It's relevant when you read the autobiography. One person said after reading the interpretation, the explanation of the Gita, which Swamiji channeled through Master's teachings, said that when I was growing up, we all read the Gita and worshipped it, but it was as if we were pouring milk on this image, this murti. Now, for the first time in my life, reading this book, now I can drink the milk. And so when religion is just outward, or when scripture is outward or in the past or doesn't relate to us, then we don't draw anything from it. And in some cases, by rejecting it, we reject an upward path that will bring us happiness. And so for me, the autobiography brings all of those things together. And so, but it's far, far more than just the knowledge that it brings, just the understanding of those scriptures. What really happens for me in the autobiography is that my heart and my yearning becomes awakened. Because that book begins and ends with Master's vibration. And Master's vibration is one of a deep devotee, as Devi was saying, discipleship and Kriya Yoga. Kriya, the ultimate expression of meditation. But meditation, the inward life, all of those things come together. But more than anything, it's Master's vibration. I had read those sometimes in other books, but they didn't come alive for me. And I don't think it's only because I'm a disciple of Master and have long been, in many lifetimes, I mean, a disciple of Master. I think it's also the particular genius with which he writes that book. It's so charming, and it's so simple, and it's filled with miracles. And you read those miracles, and you read those stories, and you read just even a paragraph of it, and it just touches you in a way that makes you say, I want to be like that. I want to live like that. I want to become what Master was, what he saw in these others. And so it awakens more than anything else. It awakens one's yearning for God. And that's the most important thing of all. Without that, you can read all the scriptures on all the shelves in the world, and it won't touch you very much. If it's just intellectual, we've met people who can quote the scriptures and who know the Sanskrit and know the English translation of it, know the whole of the Gita, and it hasn't touched them, hasn't awakened them. It's just like an intellectual exercise. You know, I'm Tale of Two Cities. Well, they've memorized, I'm the Gita. They've memorized that Gita, but it hasn't changed them. How much better to read a little bit of autobiography, which is the living Gita. Because that which Master talks about is philosophy translated for us with the vibration that he brings to it. And in that translation, it awakens the yearning of the heart for something higher. Now, we might call that something different. One person might call it Jesus, another might call it Krishna, another might call it light, another might call it enlightenment. But it awakens in us the desire for something higher. And that awakened desire is the single most important thing of all. One time, as somebody said to Ananda Moy Ma, he said, isn't the desire for God just another desire? Because we're supposed to get rid of desires, isn't that just another desire? And Ma said, yes, it is. But it's the only desire that gets rid of all the other desires. And so what that book does is it awakens in us the desire for union with God, however we define that. Because how we define that stems from our ignorance, doesn't stem from wisdom. It's like, as Devi was saying, the autobiography is like a living scripture, but it carries, for those of us who read it, our memory banks are filled from Kali Yuga, not from higher sources. So if we define God, that definition is often something that we've been told, something we've read. It's a Kali Yuga definition of God. And that Kali Yuga definition of God, we look at and say, I'm not interested in that. That doesn't appeal to me. Well, it shouldn't, in a certain sense. It should be a starting point. As Vivekananda said, it's a blessing to be born into a religion, but a curse to die in one. And so that having that foundation is a blessing, but then religion is outward, spirituality is inward. And more than anything, what the autobiography did for me was awakened that inward yearning and gave it form, gave it words, gave it images, and most of all gave it a direction. And then I was fortunate, within a couple of months after reading that and not knowing what more to do, to come to a living representative of that book, to meet Swamiji, and to be, as one of our dear friends, Devi Mukherjee, wrote a book, Shaped by Saints, because he wanted his life, he went from saint to saint, he wanted his life to be shaped by the saints. And so after reading the autobiography, my life became shaped by Swamiji. And Swamiji was, if anything, a living representative of Master's vibration for me and for thousands of others. So one could say a living representative of that tradition that Master captured in the autobiography of a yogi. And so most of us here have been shaped by Swamiji, certainly shaped by Master, certainly shaped by the autobiography. But if I had not found Swami, if Swami, I'll depersonalize it, if Swami hadn't been there to be found by so many of us, what would we do with the autobiography? It would be an experience, it would be something precious, but it would be a book on the shelf. It wouldn't be a life, it wouldn't be a path, it wouldn't be a living reality. The other thing that the autobiography does is it keeps me in tune. Attunement master often said is the most important thing of all. And by reading, rereading, listening to the autobiography, not only that, but meditating, doing the very best I can as a yearning soul to attune to Master, to attune to the truths that he represents. It's as if that autobiography is a living light, a torch that I carry with me. And that torch shines into the little dark nooks and crannies of my consciousness. And so I can be sitting in meditation and there will be something in my consciousness, something maybe that I'm unsure of. And if I just think of Master or think of a story from the autobiography of a yogi, think of an episode, just tune in. It's as if that tuning in shines a torch into that little dark corner, and all of a sudden I see more clearly. Or if my conscience is a little bit worried about something, maybe I watched a movie that pulled my consciousness down, which I do too many of them. It's hard to find one that doesn't. Swami finally zeroed in on about five, Bambi and Lady and the Tramp, and you know. So if you watch media, it's hard to find anything that doesn't pull your consciousness down, and yet we have the desire, the need to relax, and so it isn't a big deal, but there is a line for me where I cross it, and my conscience will say, you shouldn't have read that one, or you shouldn't have watched that one. And all I need, I can ignore it for a little while, but if I tune into Master's vibration, as he said, I will speak to you through your conscience. And if I tune into his vibration, it's as if he sends an empowering signal through my own conscience, and my own conscience then instructs me, shouldn't do that, should do that. And it keeps that alignment until finally I can say, now after it's been more than 50 years since I read Autobiography of a Yogi, I can say now that that book has shaped my life and continues to shape my life. But more than the book, the vibration of Master, the teachings of Master, the love of Master, the joy of all of those things that are in there, that vibration has shaped my life and continues to shape my life. And the yearning to be like Master has grown stronger and stronger over these 50 years. It was there immediately when I read that book, but it has grown stronger and stronger until that vibration, that yearning, has pretty much driven out everything else. And that's the power of that book. That's the power of Master, that the light drives out all desire to hold on to any of those dark nooks and crannies. And when that desire to hold on to them, to protect them, to have the ego protected in some way, when that desire leaves and is replaced by a deep, abiding, powerful yearning for the light and for union with God, then we know that the scriptures that we've been studying have come alive in us, because that's what they're meant to do, to awaken that love. As Jesus summarized it beautifully, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy mind, with all thy soul, and with all thy strength. And the real study of the scriptures is meant to bring us to that heightened sense of love where everything we are is pointed toward the love of God.